KALW.
What we were fighting for became harder and harder to see.
The battle for People's Park in Berkeley has been going on for more than 50 years.
It was an effort that brought together all kinds of people in Berkeley, the Quakers and pacifists and street people, professors.
Today we'll hear about how it all started. Then writer Arisa Wright tells the story of her internal struggles growing up without her father in her newest book, Who's Your Daddy?
This journey towards the father is also a journey to like recovering parts of myself.
And we hear a reading from El Cerrito poet Ma Shane Wynn.
It's a collection of poems around the themes of containment and liberation, and originally inspired by my obsession with storage units.
Local literary voices and more. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The battle over the right to access People's Park in Berkeley began more than 50 years ago, but it never really ended. It continues even today as Berkeley students and other activists protest a UC Berkeley plan to build housing there.
We belong here. This is our home.
We're not worried about burnout. We're going to be here. And we're going to be here till the very end.
Back in 2019, KALW's Holly J. McDeed reported on the contentious history of People's Park. Here's Holly.
A reggae band is jamming on stage at People's Park in Berkeley by Telegraph Avenue. Only a few people are in the crowd, but the musicians don't take it personally.
So the people should be here. But anyway, all the people that are here today, I say, yo!
A few people are sound asleep on benches and on the grass. Others are hanging out in groups by the garden or underneath the trees. Roosevelt Stevens sits with a sketch pad.
Meth heads up there. The alcoholics over here. And you got the potheads here.
He tells me his park name is Obi-Wan Kenobi because people go to him for advice. He's been coming here since the 70s. He says this park is grittier than your average Berkeley park.
It has values, it has significance. Because this is the Mecca, the park, where people come for help.
People come here for a lot of reasons. The free food from Food Not Bombs, to use the restroom, to offer support for each other. And Michael Dowdy, he plays chess on the rickety picnic tables. Like a lot of people who use the park, Dowdy is homeless.
I think I found myself here because every place else you could feel the energy of people pushing you away. And this was the only place I was accepted.
But it may not stay this way. UC Berkeley plans to develop the park for housing.
This is the place where the people took a stand, and it's amazing that it's still here.
The university also had plans to develop this plot of land back in 1969. Back then, activist Michael Delacour says it was basically a mud hole. He invited people to the park to protest against the Vietnam War. Pistol
shots ring out in a bar. We had rallies every weekend. It was a place where I could get across the message on the war. That was my main goal.
Soon, the Berkeley Bar Weekly dubbed the park a cultural, political freakout and rap center for the Western world. Students, activists, and families arrived with shovels, sod, and plants to turn that mud hole into a park.
Of the students that came here, they never had a shovel in their hand. The slogan we have, everybody gets a blister, well, that sort of says we're trying to involve everybody.
Then, less than a month later, on May 15th, 1969, police put up a fence around the entire park. And as you can hear in this archival footage, protesters moved to defend the space.
Don't let yourselves get arrested on felony. Go down there and take the park.
Someone opened up a fire hydrant and police fired tear gas. Protesters threw bottles and rocks back at them.
Sheriffs went up and got their weapons and started shooting them.
They've got shotguns now and they're using them on people. Somebody was just shot with birdshot.
James Rector, a bystander, was shot by police and died days later. A man was blinded for life. Tom Dalzell, the author of The Battle for People's Park, says what became known as Bloody Thursday was a turning point because it was so violent. After that, Governor Ronald Reagan sent over 2,000 National Guard troops. A helicopter even dropped tear gas on the city.
This was a tactic developed for Vietnam that they tested in Berkeley. The tear gas drifted a couple miles north and south, kids were sick from the tear gas, went in the hospitals.
Days later, 30,000 people took to the streets for the largest demonstration in Berkeley's history. Quaker leaders trained marchers to keep the peace. Protesters baked pot brownies for the troops.
It was an effort that brought together all kinds of people in Berkeley, the Quakers and pacifists and Marxists and Stalinists and street people, professors.
Dalzell says no one ever really won the fight for People's Park, and activists soon splintered into factions. The idealism of the 60s was replaced by the skepticism of the 70s and the greed of the 80s.
And Berkeley changed, not as much as the rest of the country, but Berkeley changed. And what we were fighting for became harder and harder to see. And what the park became was farther and farther from the original vision. I hope that it's not forgotten.
The university attempted to build on the land again. In 1991, protesters clashed with police for days over plans for volleyball courts. But UC Berkeley spokesperson Dan Mogiloff says this most recent plan to build housing is urgent.
The plan for housing at People's Park is part of a broader university initiative to address a really serious crisis. And I'm referring to a student housing crisis.
Mogiloff says the park is a good site for housing because it's close to campus and underused. Besides, he says, over the years, it's become a locus for crime. Police were called to the park over 10,000 times from 2013 to 2018.
There was a shooting there. There was a baby who was given methamphetamines. I mean, there have been a whole series of things that have happened in and around that park that don't exactly provide an incentive to those who want to visit it.
The university also plans to build a memorial to honor the park's history. Mogiloff says the park no longer represents the ideals of those who fought for it. He says the plan to build housing does.
If one were to wander into Berkeley and come across that park, you would have no idea what happened there 50 years ago. We actually want to change that. We want to make sure people understand what went on there. You can't do that today.
But if you do stumble into People's Park at just the right moment, you can still find acts of resistance. It's like an echo of the activists who fought for it 50 years ago.
All of us. They won't be able to stop it. They won't be able to stop it just like they couldn't stop it in the 60s.
In the fall of 2019, a member of the People's Park Committee, Aiden Hill, went up to the mic for a rally at the park.
If they keep trying to push us out of it, we're going to fight back with everything we have.
The university hasn't shown signs of backing down from their plan since then, and so Hill and others continue to organize. In Berkeley, for Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks, Holly. The next People's Park Committee event will be a General Assembly meeting and film screening. That's tomorrow, March 5th at 3 p.m. UC Berkeley's governing board will ultimately have the final say on the project, and that's expected later this year. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Poetry meets memoir in the new book, Who's Your Daddy? By Arisa White. It's a coming-of-age journey about Arisa as a young, queer Black woman carrying the void of not knowing her father, Gerald. She takes readers from her childhood in Brooklyn, New York, to the time she lived in Oakland and her father's country, Guyana. Arisa spoke with KALW's Janae Darden.
I can't wait to dig into this book, but before we do that, how were you introduced to poetry? And I know you talk about that in your book.
I always come back to my family. There was this kind of artful practice happening in my immediate family. We had a camcorder. We would make commercials from Minute Maid juice and make rap videos. And then when we would gather during holidays, just the storytelling, the shooting of the dozens, people just, you know, being loud and beautiful. I believe that's where I fell in love with language.
And then a teacher introduced you to Audre Lorde?
Yes, my global studies teacher gave me an anthology called Ain't I a Woman? In that book, I came across Audre Lorde's On the Night of the Full Moon. I just fell in love with that poem. I was like, oh my God, this poem is so sensual. And I love the way that it's erotic and it talks about women loving women in this beautiful way. And I think in many ways that was like my coming out poem. It's sweet how like there was a kind of conflux of both poetry and my queer identity and loving the feminine.
And you mentioned something earlier about language and growing up with family. And you grew up in a time in Brooklyn in the 80s and the 90s. And I'm just thinking about just hip-hop culture and just language at that time. Did that influence you at all, too?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm also thinking about, like, the whole neo-soul movement, too. So Erykah Badu. Yes. And then, of course, like, Biggie. I could, like, walk down Biggie's neighborhood and there Biggie was playing. And then also, I think, too, about my cousin, Sean, JC, just kind of growing up and him and my cousins would be beatboxing and banging beats on the table. So there was, you know, this sense of like how to flow and how to be witty in your flow. And then me and my brother will go back home and we'll start banging beats out on the table. And then there was something so like wonderfully Black about it too, especially the way that Erykah Badu presented like Blackness and this Nubian vibe. And then in that, there was this way for me to express being a Black woman in ways that I borrowed from African symbology, as well as sort of like Brooklyn street slang.
Let's go to the West Coast.
Okay, yay!
So while you were here, you had a letter writing project. Talk about that letter writing project that led to this book, Who's Your Daddy?
What actually led me to write Who's Your Daddy was my mom. I think it was my 33rd birthday, so it was like my Jesus year. And my mom can be very Christian in that way. So she was like, I have an address for your father in Guyana. Do you want to write him? And I was like, I don't know yet. Like, I don't know what to say. The way that I kind of encouraged my voice was to write letters, like poetry letters, epistolary poems. And then I applied for this grant. And the project that I proposed was three-pronged. I would self-publish those letters that I was writing, those epistolary poems. Also host a series of community-based workshops so folks can do the same thing. They can write letters to their strange, absent, dead fathers and patriarchal figures. They can then give me those letters in exchange for the chapbook. And so it was like this letter exchange project. I give you my letters to my father for your letter to your father. And then the third part of that project was to go to Guyana, meet my father, give him that like collection of epistolary poems I was writing, and just to visit the country and ask, you know, some deep questions about where he was, what was he doing, why wasn't he in my life?
Do you always feel something was missing inside of you, or something was missing about you because of his absence?
I did, only because people would tell, like, question it. So it's like when you come into those middle school years and it's like a mark of why you're on welfare, or it's a reason for something. And then even in this national way, we have these tropes about the Black father and the Black mother. And so you begin to angle your vision to see yourself according to a Moynihan report. And that's the tension I felt. So I think the book was just this way of kind of bringing some peace to that tension of what people expect of you, and to kind of wrangle myself out of these like stereotypical narratives that try to tell me who I am and who I will become as a result of something missing.
How did your father's absence affect how you loved?
I was fashioning my most sensitive parts behind a wall and keeping it separate from other people and keeping it separate from my romantic dynamics. And I just started to feel empty as a result. And so for me, this kind of journey of meeting my father and then thinking about abandonment and how I'm sort of reproducing my absence in people's lives by not being sort of fully there, really was like, okay, this journey towards the father is also a journey to like recovering parts of myself that I felt like I abandoned in order to like not show any weakness.
I've had to work through my daddy issues. You get tired.
Yeah.
You get tired.
You totally do. You totally do.
You're like, I'm tired of myself. I'm tired of acting like this.
Exactly.
And you know, this is a heavy topic, but there's also humor in your book.
Yeah, I'm glad you noticed it.
Did you do that intentionally to, just because I know it's a heavy topic, or did it just flow naturally?
Yeah, it just flowed naturally, actually. It was kind of nice to have that come out while writing this work. But also there was something absurd about all of this too, in a way. It's like I go to Guyana and I meet my father. He doesn't show up for the first few days. I like travel all this way and he's not answering his phone. And when he finally arrives, you know, he's like asking me for money. He wants me to pay his rent. And in that moment, I was able to sort of see like something, like a dark humor in it.
You know, sometimes we come to a point as adults where we realize our parents aren't perfect.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that was one of the gifts of going to Guyana is that, you know, my father is going to tell me his side of the story, which, you know, certain things that my mom left out. And in some ways, there was this ability to even forgive, you know, like to forgive my mother, to forgive my father, and just kind of have that relief and to see them as like lovers and excited about each other. And that is what, you know, carried me through in writing this, is like really centering their love and the love that still remains in both of them as they talk about each other.
What's your relationship like with Gerald, your father now?
It's distant. It's pretty much like how it was before all of this happened.
So you all haven't talked or?
No, we haven't.
You accepted what it is and you go forward.
Yeah, I just, you know, I don't feel any kind of feelings about it. Like it feels neutral, it feels settled. It feels like a kind of peace. So whatever came, what I needed, I got. And so I wasn't really looking to build a relationship with my father. And especially to knowing that I would need to support him financially. That's something I wasn't capable of. I'm in the place where there's like no anger and no anxiety.
That's wonderful that you've been able to go forward. Would you mind reading a piece?
Dear Gerald, I am Denise's daughter. Little girl, I was thought you were loved by way of disappearing. I have been a screen for gazing, allowing the bigger picture to eat the smaller picture. You're one of the classic oldies reeled from my heartbreak. I cheated in my last relationship and my feelings coalesced for you. That girl child me, full of so much fight and sorrow, is tail chasing in a scapegoated posture a perfumer would call fecal. I'm tired of feeling like shit, blurred vision from spinning. I cannot see clearly my belonging.
That was poet Arisa Wright speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. Arisa's book, Who's Your Daddy, is out now. Find a link at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, we're bringing you some more poetry. It's our podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a socially distanced book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Poet Ma Shane Nguyen lives in El Cerrito. Her book, Storage Unit for the Spirit House, came out in October.
It's a collection of poems around the themes of containment and liberation, and originally inspired by my obsession with storage units and spirit houses. And here's a poem from my book. Spirit House 4. Sibling follows sibling into thorn forest. Girl holds stick of incense, tip aglow. 37 knots await atop Mount Popa. Volcanic relics, sister, brother, blue-throated barbets. Lightning clue, nest lands on soft earth, entwined vines. Distant blaze, candlewick floating in bowl of oil.
That was Ma Shane Nguyen reading from Storage Unit for the Spirit House.
New Arrivals is produced by KALW's Lisa Morehouse. Find out how to subscribe to the podcast at kalw.org/newarrivals. And before we go, here's some music from a local artist. This is Javier Santiago from Oakland. His new album, Verses Volume 2, came out last month. All I do is speak my mind line for line. Hopefully it could pass by, touch a life. Or maybe it won't. Or maybe it don't. Or maybe we can go to another space, place, or a time. Gateways here, it's time to fly. Or maybe we grow.
Ever met a frequent flyer who's flying with no wings? Call me Sire, I'm king-hearted when I sing. I'm from the bottom, dealing with Sodom. All the horror, Gomorrah, and Solemn. Mind is like an asylum. What you find when inside is a soul clear as a diamond. Precious as a spirit surrounding divine shamans. Who want problems, face cruising like autopilot. No one like it, no one like them. You don't like them? I shrug shoulders, move mountains, and live life, man. Stay colder like I live polar. Haters, get vitamin D, I breathe
sober. Today's Cross Currents team includes Azul Ekman, David Exume, Annalise Finney, Sonia Narang, and Marissa Ortega Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Henat Baba.
I stay ahead as a halo, even though when I lay low, bars are like Barbados, style sorta like Play-Doh. Make something great, touch the Republic like Play-Doh. Fatal, where my brain go, walk in my lane, end up walking in shame slow. You gas like propane, a plane, the flamethrower. For 40 days, I ride waves like Phase Noah. Intoxicate, never remember your day sober.